Hey, everybody, and welcome back to All Crime, No Cattle. We're your Texas True Crime podcast, and I'm one of your hosts, Shay. Today, we're going to be talking about some interesting topics that Aaron is kind of an expert at. And I think she's really excited.
Far from an expert.
Well, either way, she's really excited, and she's got some knowledge to throw down on you guys. And
she's going to lay down some learning.
She might have a bone to pick with this case.
Oh, nice.
All right. Well, other than that, we have a little bit of preamble this episode, and we're going to bring up something really cool that our show and a bunch of other shows are going to be pushing, and it's a really cool fundraiser. Aaron, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about it?
Well, this fundraiser is for the organization Texas EcuSearch. This is a nonprofit organization. They assist in missing person searches. Basically, there are a bunch of people who have access to horses, and they can get out into really remote areas and look for missing people. They have assisted on over 1,500 missing person cases. It's a really great organization and something that we really want to support. And right now, unfortunately, they are kind of low on funding. So they're actually doing a donation drive right now. And we think it's really important, and so does everybody, all of the podcasters we've talked to. And so what we're going to be doing is a little exciting. So this is the thing. If you go to their website at texasecusearch.org, which is EcuSearch is spelled E-Q-U-U, search. If you go there and make a donation, you can also go to their Facebook page and make a donation. Or if you go to our Facebook page, we have a little fundraiser already set up with the link and everything for you to make the donation. If you make a $5 donation, you will be entered to win a merch package of All Crime No Cattle gear.
Hey-o.
This is going to be some stickers, either a coffee mug or water bottle. It's whatever your choice is, and your pick of one of our beautiful t-shirts. So that's going to be really cool. If you decide to donate $20 or more, you will be entered into a larger giveaway. And this is going to be a ton of different merch from a lot of different amazing podcasts. So we've got Gone Cold, Whiskey Boy Radio, True Crime Fan Club, Swindled, Nerds from the Crypt, Avert Your Eyes, Lone Star Lawn Disorder, Murder City, True Crime of Houston, Stat Tales, and just recently, Steven from Trace Evidence said he wants to get on board as well. So he's going to be offering some merch. So you're going to get like this enormous merch package of all sorts of amazing stuff. If you do that $20 donation, that's the raffle that you're going to be entered into. So it's going to be super, super cool. So basically all you have to do, like I said, go online, make your $5 or $20 donation or whatever denomination you're comfortable with. Take a screenshot of your receipt and send that on over to allcrimenocattle@gmail.com, and we will enter you into the raffle. It's that easy.
Yeah.
And you're going to be supporting a really, really great cause. This is not even just a Texas-based organization, just to be clear.
Yeah.
They work on cases from around the country. It's a very important organization. It's something that, you know, if you or a loved one goes missing, you want them to be around to help you out.
They're such a great asset to have on a search for someone. Just because of the use of the horses gives you a lot of advantages when searching Texas areas or rugged terrains, stuff like that. And I think the term EcuSearch comes from the fact that they use horses, correct?
Yeah, equine.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So be sure to do that. Again, we're going to be probably running this for at least a month or so. So you've got a little bit of time. We'll keep putting out reminders and everything, but be sure to make your donations and get your receipts in to us. And some of the other podcasters are also offering their own $5 donation raffle. So be sure to send that in, and you can maybe win some cool stuff.
Yeah, get that $20 in, get everybody's prizes.
That's right.
That's right. How about we move on to our case today, Aaron? Tell us a little bit about what we're going to be talking about.
All right. Well, this case I first found on the old standby, Forensic Files. And I became really interested and invested in this case, and we're going to see why once I get into it. Unfortunately, when I then went to do additional research on this case, I discovered that there is almost literally nothing out there about this case. I was able to find a single article that was basically just announcing that the case was going to be covered on Forensic Files, and that's pretty much it besides a single court document that really wasn't much help. Other than that, there was really no news stories, no blog entries, no investigative journalist pieces, basically nothing on this case. And because of that, I was a little concerned. You know, usually we do a lot of fact checking. We do a lot of research. We compare sources, compare information that different people are reporting to make sure that we're getting the truest and most accurate story. Mm-hmm. And you can't really do that when there's not any information on the case.
It really speaks to Forensic Files, though, doesn't it? I mean, there's been a couple of other cases that we've done from Forensic Files where they're the key source.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And in this case, though, there was actually an additional TV show that was made about this case, and that was The New Detectives, which is not as quite as popular as Forensic Files, but it's the same kind of forensic type based TV program.
I've seen some episodes from that one. It's really good.
Yeah, it's good as well. So this is an interesting case because usually when we talk about a case, we kind of work from the known to the unknown. Usually we have a missing person or we have the dead body of a person and we know who that person is. And then investigators try to figure out what happened to that person from there. In this case, it's different in that we have an unidentified dead body, and investigators have to first identify who that person is before the investigation into their death can even proceed. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about the sometimes unsung heroes of the world of true crime, and that's the scientists who work to identify human remains. And that means, Shay, my dear husband, my dear listeners, I get to talk about my favorite thing in the whole world, bones. I am very excited.
The bone lady has arrived.
Exactly. I am in my element right now. So the episode of Forensic Files is season 10, episode 6, entitled Headquarters. And the New Detectives episode is season 2, episode 5, entitled Faces of Tragedy. So as far as the skeletal assessment is concerned, both shows go over it kind of vaguely. So we're going to get into really those details. How do you estimate the age of an individual at death? How do you tell if skeletal remains are male or female? So if you have those kinds of questions and you're kind of interested in forensic science, hopefully you'll learn a thing or two in this episode, and hopefully it's not boring. But I'm really excited. I'll do my best.
Well, and for everybody who doesn't know anything about bones, I'm right there with you. So I'm gonna help throw some lifelines.
Yeah, definitely. Because I had to calm myself down. I wanted to add like everything. And I was like, no, Aaron, this is going to be super obnoxious. So I'm going to try to make it pretty clear, pretty entry level descriptions of how you do these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll be interesting for you guys. This case begins in Yellow House Canyon outside of Lubbock. Have you ever heard of Yellow House Canyon?
No, I haven't, but I've been to Lubbock a few times.
Yeah. Well, this is actually mostly within the city limits of Lubbock. It does kind of spread out outside of Lubbock a little, as far as I understand it. But pretty much this canyon area is within the city limits of Lubbock. It has dams throughout the canyon area, and these together form the Canyon Lakes. The river that has cut through this area is the North Fork Double Mountain Fork Brazos River. Which is a mouthful. So typically it's just called the North Fork or the Yellow House Creek.
But it's part of the Brazos watershed.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
And I looked at pictures of this area. It looks like a really pretty area. There are lots of course, parks, camping areas, a lot of outdoorsy things you can do, geologic formations that you can look at. It looks like a really cool little area. In late 1994, two hunters were wandering around this Yellow House Canyon when they came across human skeletal remains. These two were not only trespassing on private land, but they were also poaching because they were hunting on private land. So instead
not
of
good guys.
No, don't do that, guys. Well, instead of immediately reporting the find, they left because they were worried about getting in trouble. These two are not into true crime. Every true crime person's like greatest dream is to find a dead body and be able to be the one to report it.
You know, this is something that's come up before with authorities where even detectives and police officers have said, you know, if you come across human remains, even if you're doing something illegal, just go ahead and report it. And 9 times out of 10, the authorities are just willing to look the other way.
Yeah,
about
absolutely.
What you were
and
doing.
You can also report things anonymously. You can say, hey, I found this bone, these bones here. Goodbye.
Yep.
Guys, just be smart about it. Well, fortunately, though, these two did have big mouths. So they ended up telling a friend that they found this dead body. And the friend then did the right thing and contacted the sheriff's department. And the two hunters did end up leading authorities to the scene.
Well, good on this friend.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, guy. A wide area around the remains was taped off and the entire area was searched to find any additional bones or evidence. The remains were scattered a bit and some elements were pretty fragmented. But altogether, they were able to recover a good amount of the body, including the skull. And surprisingly, they were also able to recover every single tooth from the skull. And I say surprisingly because teeth are anchored in place by a ligament called the periodontal ligament. So when that tissue decays, the teeth are just sort of sitting in their sockets. And they actually have the tendency to just fall right out. So that's why if you find a skull, like an animal skull in the woods, you'll have missing teeth. Or maybe you can actually just take a tooth and just pull it right out. And that's because it's really the tissues that hold those teeth into place. So it's actually pretty fortunate that they were able to recover all of the teeth in this skull, even though these remains were kind of scattered around this area.
Yeah.
Other than the bones and the teeth, a single white shoe was discovered. And that's it. No identification, no other clothing or belongings or anything else were discovered with this body. So we have a partial skeleton and a shoe. So how do you move on from there to try to analyze completely skeletonized human remains to help you identify who that person was in life?
I don't know, but I get the feeling that you're right about to tell us.
Oh, we're going to find out. So when skeletonized human remains are first discovered, usually the first and easiest thing to do is sex the individual. Pause here for Shay's inevitable giggling fit. Because every time in grad school, every time I was like, I've got to sex this person or whatever, he'd be like, hey, hey, hey.
I got a bone you can sex.
Oh, Lordy.
All right, I'm done.
Well, the remains went to forensic anthropologist Dr. Harold Gill King for analysis. And in the Forensic Files episode, they really skate on by how they sexed this individual. They basically said that the forensic anthropologist identified the sacrum as female, and bing, bang, boom, the person was female. Well, that's not really how it works. So let's talk about what goes into sex estimation of skeletal remains. And just to be clear, when we talk about assessing sex, we're purely referring to biological sex and not gender, which is a social construct. So when we talk about assessing sex, we're talking just about the biological expression of either male or female characteristics, not how a person may have identified or expressed themselves in real life. Sex estimation is based on humans' sexual dimorphism, which is the fancy scientific term for the differences in size and shape between males and females. Generally speaking, males tend to be taller with more muscle and body mass than females, although this can be pretty variable. And that's because humans aren't as sexually dimorphic as some other animals. So, for example, gorillas, They are primates, so they're very closely related to us, and they exhibit the most sexual dimorphism in modern primates today. Males are like twice the size of females. They look completely different.
They do. Their skulls look opposite. Like, one is crazy huge and big. It has a giant crest going down the middle, and the females are more like rounded and smaller. Just
grass when
you
aisle.
Look, grass aisle, yes. Just when you look at skulls, not alone the rest of the whole specimen.
There's a very clear difference, yes. Well, obviously, we're not as extreme as that. So it's going to be a little bit more difficult to tell the differences between males and females, but it is totally possible at the same time. So if you have a complete pelvis, sexing is going to be easy as hell, and that's because the pelvis usually exhibits the most extreme traits of sexual dimorphism.
Ooh, I know.
Why is that, Shay?
It's because the gap in the center of the pelvis, I don't know the bone terminology, I took biological anthropology a long time ago, it's going to be much wider so that childbirth can happen.
Yes, exactly. So human females give birth to ridiculously big-headed babies, and so the differences between the sexes are best seen in the pelvis because of this. The pelvis is comprised of two os coxae, which are also called innominates, and these are the big old weird-looking bones that form the hips. And then at the back is the sacrum, which is a triangular-shaped bone at the base of the spine, and it's basically comprised of between 4 to 6 vertebrae that are actually fused together.
It's also connected to the coccyx,
right? Yes. The coccyx is there as well, but it's rather unimportant.
Is our old lingering vestigial tail.
That's right, yeah. Well, in females, the pelvis is generally wider, as you were saying. It has a more oval pelvic inlet. That's the term that you were looking for. And that's the area through which a baby would pass. Males' pelvic inlets tend to be more heart-shaped and constrained. And this is something that you can glance at, and it's a pretty obvious difference. The os coxae themselves are actually the most reliable bones to help you determine sex. In fact, if you have a single complete os coxa of an individual, you can estimate the sex of that person with around 95% accuracy.
Oh, wow.
So this is a really reliable way to tell sex.
So as Shakira would say, the hips don't lie.
The hips don't lie.
Yeah, look at that.
The sacrum, on the other hand, is far less reliable by itself. Typically, a female sacrum is wide, it's shorter, and it doesn't curve as far forward as a male sacrum does. And again, this is essentially to keep it out of the way of childbirth.
Gotta keep that baby tube open.
The sacrum of this individual that was found in the canyon, it looked more female. It had these female characteristics. But by itself, like I said, a sacrum isn't a reliable element used in sex scenes. So that kind of begs the question, why did the show specifically mention only the sacrum in determining sex?
That is interesting.
Can you figure out why?
Is it because they didn't have ascoxae?
Yes, that's exactly right. Very good. In this case, they actually did not recover the ascoxae of this individual. So they only had the sacrum to go on as far as any pelvic bones are concerned.
So that's why there's such a focus on that particular bone. See, I'm pretty good at this, even though I took these classes years ago.
You are a genius.
I did make an A in them. I just don't remember anything about them.
Well, it was a really long time ago. We're old. Well, let's say you don't have the pelvis, or specifically the ascoxae, like they did not have in this case. What is the best thing besides that to help to determine sex?
Skull, I would
think. Yes.
Yeah.
Ding, ding, ding. So far, I think you have 100 so far in this pop quiz.
Yeah, man, it's per use, you know?
Well, the skull is comprised of the cranium and the mandible, or the lower jaw, and using features from these elements can determine sex with about 85% accuracy. So it's lower than what you can find in the ascoxae and in the pelvis, of course, but it's still a pretty valid and reliable method. And in this case, we know that they did recover the skull of this individual. So this is probably how they actually identified the remains, not just the sacrum.
Yeah, and you were saying they found all the teeth too, which is miraculous. So I was assuming they had the skull with the teeth, not
exactly.
Just the teeth.
Well, I mean, you can find just teeth.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, teeth are the most indestructible. No, it wouldn't be weird. Teeth are the most indestructible parts of a human body. So a lot of times, especially if you're talking about very old remains, a lot of times you might just find teeth.
Mm, good point.
So again, there are morphological differences between males and females that are often expressed in the skull. And again, this usually has to do with muscle attachment. So let's play a little game. I'm very excited about this.
Okay.
I'm going to go over some of these differences, and you, Shay, and the listeners can assess the features of your own skulls. And if you have a friend or family member or coworker nearby, go ahead and touch their skulls too. They'll appreciate it. Just tell them it's for science.
They'll appreciate it for sure. Just grab a random person's skull, not even a family member. If like you're in the mall, just go up and start touching somebody's head.
It's fine.
Yeah,
exactly. And this is true. Once you know a lot about bones, especially the bones of the skull and the face, you will constantly be analyzing people's skulls under their skin. Mm-hmm.
We do it all the time.
It's pretty metal.
Yeah. I don't know about metal, but
I love it.
There'll be times where we'll like be on the train to Dallas or something, and Aaron will like nudge me and be like, look at that dude's brow ridge. It's amazing. And I'll be like, oh my God, he's got Neanderthal DNA.
All right. So let's start. First, touch the back of your skull at the midline.
Got to take my hat off here. Okay. Touching the skull.
At the midline, a few inches above your hairline. If you feel around in that area, you'll find a bump. Mm-hmm. Do you feel it, Shay?
Yep.
This is called the external occipital protuberance. And this is an attachment point for neck muscles and the trapezius muscle. So the trapezius is that big muscle that's kind of like the upper back. Yeah, the upper back, and it goes up into your neck and then it attaches in this area, not just the occipital protuberance, but there's also sort of attachment areas all kind of around it.
Okay.
This is a really highly variable feature that tends to be larger and more pronounced in males. And it can actually get crazy big with a huge hook to it, which is really interesting to see. So like I said, it's very variable. You can find a skull that is almost completely gracile where you can't really even see the protuberance exactly. And then you'll have one that's like a finger sticking out of the skull. Bones respond to dynamic forces and things like muscle attachment and everything that you kind of put your body through. So if you have really heavy musculature, that means that those attachment points are going to be a little bit bigger on the skull. So you can kind of tell those things just looking at the bone, even if you don't have any muscle tissue available. All right. So next, take your finger and put it behind and a little underneath your ear and kind of move it up and down. Now, this is a little bit harder to feel because it's usually covered in a lot of tissue in life, but this is called the mastoid process. So this is like this weird, lumpy thing of bone that juts out from the skull immediately behind and below the external auditory meatus. Or as most of us know it, the ear hole.
Yeah, I feel it.
And again, this serves as muscle attachment for a lot of the muscles in the head and neck. So a lot of the muscles that help you turn your neck and swivel and kind of move up and down, those attach right there to that mastoid process. And again, it's usually longer, wider, thicker, more voluminous in males than it is in females.
Strong necks.
Well, next, take your finger and put it on the bridge of your nose and move your finger up. So up into your forehead about an inch or so. This is a cranial landmark called the glabella. And in males, the glabella is typically more pronounced than in females. So I have a very feminine glabella. Let me touch your glabella. By the way, tell people that you're going to touch their glabella. See what they say about it. Oh, you've got a... You actually also have a very gracile glabella.
Yeah,
that's funny.
I was going to say. I don't see a pronounced one on my face.
No, you don't. But again, and that's actually a really good point, is these features individually will be variable. What you're going to be looking at is the complete suite of characteristics. You're going to be looking at all of the lines of evidence to make these distinctions, not just like, oh, he's got a big glabella. It's a male.
Hey, sexing is complicated, man.
That's right. All right. So let's move on to the mandible. So the mandible is your lower jaw. Mm-hmm. At the front, you have your mental eminence. So that's the fancy term for your chin. And this is typically different between the sexes, with males usually having a more pronounced squared off chin. And females have a more V-shaped chin that's not as pronounced, unless you're me and you got your big giant Bruce Campbell chin.
I think you have a more like pronounced, I have a feminine chin, I feel.
You kind of do, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, your whole mandible is pretty feminine.
Yeah, my whole family's like that, though.
Yeah, they have very, oh, believe me, I've noticed.
Yeah, they have very gracile chins. That's why a lot of us have beards, to make our chins look more big and manly, I guess. Yeah.
But all of your other features of your skull, and I won't get into it, but are very masculine.
Yeah.
Besides your glabella. So move your finger down your jawline. This area of your jawline that comes away from your chin, that's called the corpus of the mandible, or the body of the mandible. Ooh. So if you follow that line back towards your neck, that line is going to kind of jut up and go up into kind of where your skull is. And that part of the mandible is called the ramus. So that's the part that actually attaches to your skull. So that angle between the corpus and the ramus is called the gonial angle. So you can feel it right there, that little corner. And in females, this tends to be more obtuse. And in males, that angle is more acute. And this is one of the reasons why we think of males of having a more pronounced kind of manly jawline, is because they've got this very kind of acute, sharp angle to their mandible. And generally, their mandibles are usually a little bit more robust. They're sturdier looking. They have more muscle attachments, etc. Well, there are lots of features like this that we could talk about, but you kind of get the idea. So there you go. Have fun with it. Go tell your boss how she has a really remarkable mental eminence, or tell the bald IT guy that he's got a stunning posterior occipital protuberance. Watch if they can figure out if you're insulting them or not.
Man, it's sexy when you talk bones.
Like I said before, it's really important to note that in analyzing basically anything when it comes to skeletal remains, you want to look at the suite of characteristics as a whole, not just one or two things. So, for example, you're not just going to use the sacrum when you have the skull to try to estimate sex.
That
you're
seems really weird now.
Exactly. You're going to use all of these landmarks and characteristics, and you're going to be using multiple lines of evidence. Basically, any of the material you have, you're going to analyze and kind of look at everything and say, overall, does this individual have more masculine traits or feminine traits?
I think that makes sense. Yeah. And that's a good little cursory glance. It's
exactly.
Sexing.
Yeah. And with this, you have a really high rate of accuracy. So with using all of these features, the forensic anthropologist was able to determine that this individual found in the canyon was most likely female.
We're going to get into aging next, I'm guessing.
The aging is next. Very good. So while sexing is relatively easy if you have certain elements, aging, or at least the aging of adults after puberty, is actually really hard.
Yeah.
And that's because skeletally, nothing really changes in your body between the end of puberty until senescence or old age. And any changes that you might see there are really affected by things like lifestyle and overall health. Aging of kids and juveniles, walk in the park. Now, obviously, I'm being a little simplistic here, but they grow and develop in a pretty consistent and predictable way. And you can use those standards to estimate age. And that's something that we know a lot about. And so it's a little bit easier. Well, it's a lot easier. But aging of adults is hard as hell. And this has led to different methods that have been developed to try to determine age. One of these methods is cranial suture aging. And this is the method that is specified in forensic files as leading to the age assessment of this individual. So we know that the cranium is made of a bunch of different bones that meet together at joints called sutures. And these, if you kind of look directly at a suture, they look like tiny little zigzags of bone that basically interlock together.
Yeah, they're kind of like how puzzle pieces fit together.
Yeah, pretty much. And through life, these sutures sometimes end up fusing together, and in fact, can fuse together so completely that you can no longer see the suture lines. And this is a process called obliteration. So the idea is that you can age an individual based on how fused or unfused the cranial sutures are. Well, the problem is we know that cranial suture fusion is actually highly variable from individual to individual. So variable, in fact, that it's honestly not a really reliable method of aging just on its own. For example, maybe someone's sutures fuse at a much earlier rate than another person's, or maybe their sutures never fuse at all, so they never become obliterated. It's not really a method that is used often alone in estimating age. While other methods that may or may not be used in age estimation usually deal with morphological changes at the joints, because this is where the skeleton really starts to show wear and tear as we age. So going back to the pelvis, the joint at which the os coxae meet the sacrum can be used, and that's the sacroiliac joint. And then the pubic symphysis in the front, where the two os coxae meet together at the front of the pelvis.
Yeah, it makes your little hula hoop circle of your pelvis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can compare those bone joint surfaces at these joints with samples where the ages are known to kind of see where the stages of aging you think the surfaces in the individual you're studying fall. Again, it's imperfect, and that's why a lot of times when you hear scientists estimating age, it's a true estimation with an age range that can sometimes be quite large. You might get an estimation of 25 to 50 years old.
Yeah, it depends on what you're looking at and what you're comparing and all that kind of good stuff.
Exactly. So yeah, it depends on the elements that they're able to recover and how many different methods they can then use to age. And then if those assessments all kind of agree with each other, because you might have an assessment of one part of the body that is older than another part of the body. So you have to make those adjustments to your age range.
Yeah. Can I guess what the last aging technique is?
Okay.
Is it dentition? Is it looking at the teeth?
Yeah, that's a very good point as well. So dentition is especially important when you're talking about children and juveniles. With an adult, obviously, you're going to have an adult set of teeth. So it's not going to be as helpful in an adult.
Until you get to senescence, like you were talking about, because then you're going to see like tooth decay and like wear and tear and stuff
yeah,
like that.
To some degree, tooth wear is going to be an indicator of age, but it's not, again, it's not something that's going to be really specific because it's so highly variable. The way your teeth occlude together, any kind of malocclusion or kind of health problems that you might have in your dental health or your hygiene, guys, floss your teeth. As somebody who has looked at a lot of skulls, floss your teeth, brush your teeth, go to the dentist, take care of them, because I've seen some nasty stuff in my life.
Yeah.
Grosses me out.
Yeah. Like, oh, those like infected holes that people get where like they don't take care of their teeth.
It's so gross. I've seen just the nastiest stuff. So it's really important to take care of your teeth. Again, once you're an adult, it's hard to really do a whole lot with teeth. You can use a little, you know, you can use some of those details, but it's not going to give you like a solid answer. Like it will with a juvenile where they're in certain stages of growth you can actually like really identify.
So with this particular case, are they looking at like the suite of all these things?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So again, just like in sexing, you would use everything. So like I said, you have those joint surfaces in the pelvis, you have rib end morphology. That can give you some indicators of age as well. And there are, again, a few other methods that you can use. And you would basically use everything you can to try to identify age. One other thing, you did mention dentition. And so we know that the third molar, so that's your wisdom teeth, those actually start to grow in a little bit later in life. They can actually still be growing in your mid-20s, for example. So you can also use that to kind of, if you have an older kid or a young adult, you can kind of use those third molars and how far grown in they are to kind of help you estimate age as well. Obviously, though, when you have third molars, a lot of people now get their third molars removed. So that can be kind of an issue. Me, for example, I got a big old mouth and I have all of my third molars. So yeah, there you go.
You just got a lot of teeth, man.
I got a lot of teeth and I got a big old mouth and a big old chin, man. There you go. I can talk a lot more about it, but I won't. So based on all of these, this suite of characteristics, again, you got dentition, you've got all of these morphological changes that the body can go through as they age. They were able to determine that this person was rather young, just on the edge of being a full adult. They estimated her age to be between 18 and 24.
Oh, okay.
Finally, a forensic anthropologist can analyze trauma to the skeleton to assess how the person died. Sometimes, however, the cause of death can be really difficult or even impossible to figure out if you only have bones. For example, if a person is acutely poisoned, you're not going to be able to tell that just by looking at the bones. But in this case, there was actually a good amount of trauma evident in the remains. There were multiple cutting or stabbing injuries throughout the torso. In total, there was one cut to the scapula, which is your shoulder blade, 6 to the vertebrae, and 4 to 5 in other places of the torso that unfortunately neither one of the TV shows specified where those places were.
So it could have been like ribs or somewhere else.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the damage to the body showed that the young woman had been stabbed between 12 and 15 times.
Wow, and that's a lot.
Yeah. And so obviously the death was ruled as homicidal violence. Let's talk about a bit of additional evidence that we can glean from that. Cut marks to the vertebrae and the scapula. What more can we tell about that kind of stabbing?
Well, it sounds like somebody just stabbed someone in the back, unless they were like running away and you're trying to capture them. But literally, it sounds like they were stabbed in the back.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got probably the most cowardly act that you can possibly imagine is stabbing somebody in the back. So yeah, absolutely, that this person, this young woman, was either fleeing from this individual that ended up killing her, or she was just attacked without even seeing him or her. There's so much more you can talk about when it comes to bones, and that's why bones are so fascinating, and that's why I love them. You can learn so much about a person's death and a person's life just by analyzing their bones. But those are the main things, kind of sexing, aging, trauma. Now authorities had some information to go on. They knew that this was a young woman around the age of 18 to 24, and that's the person that they're trying to now identify. So they checked this information against missing persons reports from the area, but they didn't find anyone that fit this description. They then checked dental records of 64 missing young women across the U.S., but again, no one matched the dental records found in the skull of the individual from Yellow House Canyon. Well, at this point, they're kind of stuck. They're at an impasse here, but they were not going to leave it at that. So as a last-ditch effort to identify this person, authorities turned to forensic artist Karen T. Taylor. Karen T. Taylor has probably got to be one of the most interesting people in the whole world. She was actually born in our home city of Fort Worth.
Oh, wow.
And she went to Pascal High School.
Wow, that's where my dad went to school.
And that's where my mom went to school.
Yeah, that's right.
And she's actually a little bit older than my mom, a little bit younger than your dad.
Wow.
I'm thinking it's totally possible she went to school with either one or both of our parents.
That's amazing.
Isn't that cool?
Wow, we need to talk to our parents about that.
I know, we really do. Well, she pioneered the development of 2D facial reconstruction. So basically, every time you see or hear about somebody using a skull to create a picture of what that person looked like in life, Karen T. Taylor is the one who developed that entire methodology.
What a badass.
Yes. She has worked on tons of cases across the country. She's had really good success in developing reconstructions that have helped to identify unknown skeletal remains. She's taught at Quantico. She's been a consultant to TV shows like Bones and CSI. She was named one of Texas's Women of the Century in 1999.
Damn.
Like, she's the real deal badass. And I'm pretty sure we met her at a Texas Archaeological Society meeting back 6-7 years ago or so.
This is what I was going to ask.
Yes.
Was that the facial reconstruction artist?
I'm like 95% sure that was her.
Okay.
So we've actually met her and went to a talk from her. She's super cool, down to earth. She has a website with a ton of information on the cases that she's covered. She has books out about her methodology and about forensic reconstruction. If you are interested in that at all, go check her out. She still does like little classes and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, at San Marcos University and and I think Texas Tech, maybe. I don't know. But so she does still teach a little bit here and there. And I really would. Oh, God, I would die to take one of her classes.
And
Karen, hit me up, girl.
Yeah, seriously. And not only does she do modern contemporary forensic stuff, but she also really delves into archaeological cases that are really old.
I mean, she's the coolest person. Well, Karen Taylor used Dr. King's reports on sex, age, all of that, to develop features for her facial reconstruction of this individual. So remember, there were no belongings or any other items that could tell you something about this victim.
Just the one shoe.
Just the one shoe, which really, do you even know that that's the person's shoe?
True.
You don't even know that.
Could be trash.
So typically, you would use the person's clothing to help indicate things like body size or weight. She didn't even have that. She only had the skull to go on. So scientists have spent a lot of time compiling facial data from males, females, young people, old people, people with different ancestry, all of those sort of things, and getting the typical ranges of these measurements for these different types of people, and then creating standard tables of measurements based on all of this data. So that means that when you go to do a facial reconstruction, you can say, well, I know I have a female of European ancestry, so I can use these certain measurements provided in this table to give me the best estimation of what those measurements should be in my reconstruction. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
And so you can use that data to figure out the depth of skin and tissue on certain parts of the face to kind of help recreate a guideline of how the face would look in life. So Karen Taylor took life-size photographs of the skull and started tracing what features, like the nose, lips, and eyes, what they would look like based on those standard tables of measurements and the unique features of the skull of the victim. It just so happens, apparently, that a U.S. quarter is almost exactly the size of a human eyeball. Huh. So she literally takes a quarter and puts it in the eye orbit and traces around it, and then she's got her eyeballs.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool. Now, in a lot of her research and all of her work, she has also noticed that the average width of the iris is between 11 and 13 millimeters. So she could use this estimation to draw in the iris of the eye. And then there are landmarks within the eye orbit that are attachment points for the eyelid. So you can kind of line all of this up together to get a good idea about what the eye would have looked like in life.
And that's important, too, because it's a lot of things is in the eyes.
The windows to the soul. Yeah. Absolutely. So to draw in the nose, you would look at the nasal aperture. So the nasal aperture is that big hole you got right in the middle of your face.
Yeah, with that weird little like bone in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The nasal aperture itself, when your skull is fully removed of flesh, it looks like a little upside down heart. Mm-hmm. And because this was a female, she knew to add about 5 millimeters to either side of this nasal aperture to get the width of the nose. She also noticed that the skull had a slanted nasal aperture, which basically one side of the nasal aperture, or picture an upside down heart. So one side of it was actually a little bit lower than the other. And she knew that it was just enough to where it would actually show up in life. So she knew that this person had a nose that was kind of a little bit slanted or tilted in real life.
Boy, I identify with that. I have a...
You got a jacked up nose.
I got a janky ass nose is what I would say.
Yeah. And I wonder, I guess it would be probably your nasal bones themselves are probably have evidence of a lot of breakage and remodeling. Yeah.
A career in adolescence in martial arts will lead to a strange looking nasal aperture.
I know. I would love to see your nasal aperture one day.
One day you will when I'm dead.
And then for the length of the nose, you look at the skull's anterior nasal spine. So that's what you were kind of talking about again. This is a little projection of bone that's right at the midline at the bottom middle of the nasal aperture. It's a little projection. The size of that projection can clue you into the size of the nose. And the way that projection points can suggest if the nose would either tip up or down or whatever.
Oh, really?
In this case, the skull had a relatively small nasal spine that pointed up a little bit at the end. So Karen T. Taylor knew to draw in a small nose that had a slight upturn to it. Now let's move on to the mouth. Well, when the mouth is relaxed, the lips will be about as wide as the front 6 teeth or about one canine to the other, just outside of where the canines are. And if you actually touch the edge, the corners of your mouth and kind of feel where those corners lay, it's about right. It's right about outside your, I'm like talking with my fingers in my mouth. It's right about outside where your canines are, between your canines and your first premolar.
Yeah, just on the outside for me.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a good indicator of how wide the mouth would be.
Man, this is a touchy-feely episode.
It's really cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I love it so much. Well, once she put all of these final touches to paper, the drawing that she created was of a woman with wide, prominent cheekbones, a square jaw, and a small, upturned nose. Authorities released this image to the media, and it was published in local newspapers. And at this point, the case was basically in the hands of the public. This was pretty much the last step they can turn to try to help identify the woman found in Yellow House Canyon.
Yeah, it's an extreme step, but it's really all they have. They don't have a whole lot to work with.
Yeah. Well, not even a week after the sketch was first released, a Lubbock woman named Beverly Tillery was drinking her morning coffee and reading the newspaper when she saw the forensic reconstruction along with an article describing the details about the unidentified woman. The sketch reminded Beverly of someone, her 17-year-old daughter, Belinda Tillery. Beverly was drawn to certain features of the face in the drawing, and we know with forensic reconstruction, it's not going to look exactly like the person.
Yeah, it's going to
give you
close.
A general idea. It's going to be something that will remind you of the person it is actually supposed to be.
Like a loose approximation.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not going to be an exact likeness. It's going to give you just a little something that might help you identify them.
Yeah.
And that's what Beverly was seeing. She was drawn to certain features of the face, the square jawline, the prominent cheekbones, the small upturned nose, the wide chin. Belinda, too, had those features. And what's more, no one had spoken to or seen Belinda Tillery for 2 years. So after confirming with family members that the sketch bore a striking resemblance to their loved one, Beverly contacted the sheriff's office to report her worst fear.
And is she in Lubbock also?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. A forensic odontologist named Dr. David Duell was tasked with comparing Belinda Tillery's dental records with the x-rays taken from the skull of the unknown victim. To compare dental structures, you'd look at the obvious stuff. The number of teeth, you're going to make sure those are the same. The shape and size of the exposed tooth, as well as the roots of each tooth. And the underlying bone structure of both the mandible and the maxilla. So basically, size and shape-wise, does this look like this?
Of your whole mouth, pretty much.
Of your whole mouth. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, you can also compare any dental work to ensure that things like fillings are in the right place and on the same tooth. Belinda Tillery had a root canal, a temporary crown, and a filling. The same teeth of the skull had the same dental work. Mm. And based on all of this evidence, Dr. Duell was able to confirm that the unidentified victim was indeed Belinda Tillery.
That's a lot of coincidences if it's not her. You know, I mean, who has that exact same mouth size, dental work? It's like a mouth fingerprint.
Yeah.
Is a good way to think about it.
Mouth fingerprint. I'm going to email my professors and say that you have a new terminology for them to go over.
Okay, don't.
Well, Belinda, she was a 17-year-old girl. She had worked as a dancer at a local strip club. And apparently this strip club was a pretty shady place, like anybody probably that would hire a 17-year-old girl.
Damn it.
Yeah. The night that she disappeared, she had worked a shift at the club, and then her brother had picked her up and given her a ride home. The brother had gone on to bed and had assumed that Belinda had gone to bed as well. But the next morning, Belinda wasn't there, and no one had seen her since. The forensic files and the new detectives' cases aren't exactly clear on this, but I guess that means that for whatever reason, Belinda's family never actually made a missing persons report on her, because they checked missing persons reports in the area and couldn't find one that matched their victim.
That was a question I had earlier on.
Exactly. It sounds like they kind of thought that she had ran away, that she had met somebody maybe.
For future reference, anybody who's ever in a similar situation where you don't know where somebody is, just go ahead and make the missing persons report.
Yeah, at least that way it's on record.
Yeah.
So they could have identified her probably a lot sooner, and they would have had to go through all these things if they had this missing persons report to fall back on. Beverly told investigators that a few weeks before she disappeared, Belinda had found out that she was pregnant. Naturally, Belinda had been pretty shocked. You know, she's 17 years old. She was upset by the news. But, you know, a few weeks after that, she decided she wanted to keep the baby, and she was already starting to make plans for her and her unborn child's futures. She wanted to go back to school. She wanted to get her diploma. She wanted to find another job that would help support herself and her new family. And she wanted to raise her child right. The father, Beverly informed investigators, was Belinda's ex-boyfriend, 27-year-old Troy Armstrong. That's right. Belinda was 17. Troy Armstrong was 27. Not good. Not good.
Yuck.
He had a history of small-time crimes. He was a drinker. He was a drug user. He was also a drifter. He didn't really have a home or an address. He kind of moved around, couch surfed, slept in his car, crashed wherever he could.
Real dirtbag.
Yeah, pretty much. Belinda's family, shockingly, did not particularly like Armstrong and weren't super crazy about Belinda dating him. They thought he was a pretty sketchy guy.
They were right.
Mm-hmm. Well, months before Belinda's body had been found, Armstrong had skipped town for good, and last anyone in Lubbock knew, he had left for Roswell, New Mexico. So Captain Tom Watson, the lead investigator in Belinda's case, made a trip out to Roswell to find Armstrong.
Why but Roswell? There's nothing out there.
Who knows? Maybe he liked aliens.
I'm hating this guy more and more as we go along.
I know. So he goes out to Roswell to try to find Armstrong, but even with all of his skills as an investigator, he couldn't track Armstrong down. He was gone, and it was odd timing, too. It was almost like Armstrong had heard about the discovery of Belinda's body and had gone into hiding. Interesting.
Yeah, so the thing I think about when I hear that he just up and went to Roswell is I'm thinking about a West Texas guy who's looking for a place to hide. And the perfect place is to go to one of these desert towns, kind of like Terlingua, Lajitas, same kind of desert Texas feel, but across state lines, which we know puts an extra barrier in there when someone's investigating you in a crime. And there's not a whole lot there. It's just like a tourist trap kind of thing. There's something to see for people who are passing through. But other than that, there's just a bunch of like desert people who are trying to get away from the hubbub and busy life of city people.
Yeah, it makes it a really good place to try to hide.
Yeah, which we see as the investigator wasn't able to locate him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was someone, though, back in Lubbock who knew Armstrong pretty well and had a lot to say. And that was Armstrong's girlfriend at the time of Belinda's disappearance, a woman named Angela Allen. It was clear to Captain Watson during his first interviews with Angela that she was holding information back. She wasn't lying or anything, but it was clear that she was afraid to tell the full story of everything that she knew about Troy Armstrong. But after speaking to her several times, Angela began to feel a little bit more comfortable, and eventually she would tell a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and soon the full story of what she knew emerged. Angela told the investigators that she and Armstrong were well aware of Belinda's pregnancy, and in fact it had been the subject of problems between Angela and Armstrong. Angela said that not too long before Belinda's disappearance, she and Armstrong were hanging out at a bar when Belinda came storming up to Armstrong, telling him how she'd been trying to contact him and that she needed to talk to him about the pregnancy. So this led to a pretty big altercation between Armstrong and Belinda that night. While Angela was kind of weirded out about the entire situation, she was older than Belinda, more settled in her life, and the drama of dating a man dealing or not dealing with an ex who was pregnant wasn't something that she was super stoked about.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. Well, Angela ended up telling Armstrong that he needed to get his life together. He needed to support Belinda in whatever decision she was going to make about the pregnancy. If she wanted an abortion, he needed to help pay for it. If she wanted to keep the baby, he would need to be financially and emotionally supportive of both Belinda and his new child. But either way, Angela was done, and she ended up breaking things off with Armstrong. Not too roughly, though, because after all, Armstrong had a temper, and he had actually gotten physical with Angela before, and he had kind of beaten her up and...
Big surprise.
Yeah, been a bit of an abuser, so she was definitely afraid of him at this point. Well, eventually, Angela dropped a pretty big bombshell. Very late, right after Belinda had gone missing, Armstrong had dropped by Angela's house and asked to come inside to clean up. Angela was horrified to see that he had blood all over his hands, and he had a cut on one of his hands. He told Angela that night that he had taken Belinda camping, and while they were out there, he had cut his hand on something, and basically he was just like, oh, I'm just dropping by after my camping trip. I cut my hand. Can I come in and wash my hands?
Weird.
Very weird. It was weird to Angela, and it was especially suspicious to the investigators because guess where he claimed to have taken Belinda camping that evening?
The exact same canyon in Lubbock?
Yep, Yellow House Canyon.
Oh, man.
This camping trip was confirmed by Armstrong's other friends, who had told investigators that shortly before Belinda's disappearance, Armstrong had asked to borrow camping gear for this trip.
This is not a person who is doing a good job covering his tracks.
It's not a smart person, for sure. Well, Angela also handed over some items that Armstrong had left at her house before he had skipped town and left to Roswell, New Mexico. One of those things was a large hunting knife. Now, blood was never found on the knife. They couldn't really identify it as being used in her murder, but the size and the shape of the knife was consistent with the knife that had been used on Belinda. Although, obviously, there's no way to really positively identify, like, this is the knife that was used to murder this victim, but this knife was consistent in those injuries that we could see in the trauma that was found on Belinda's bones.
Yeah, they probably took a micrometer and measured, like, the blade and, like, looked at the blade marks on the bones and determined that this could have been used.
Exactly. That's pretty much what it was. It was consistent. You know, if you just have marks on bones, you can't tell things like the depth of the knife that was used or, you know, a lot of really specific details. You can just say, well, it was consistent with what we're seeing in these bones. An arrest warrant was issued for Armstrong, but they still had no idea where he was. And a drifter like him could literally be anywhere in the country. But Angela told Captain Watson that Armstrong's best friend worked as a trucker. On a complete whim, Watson contacted the trucking company to see if there was any way they could help him track down the friend's truck. Turns out, they can do him one better. Their trucks were equipped with GPS.
Ooh.
Now remember, this is 1994, 1995. GPS is a brand new technology. So after explaining what GPS was to Captain Watson, they told him that not only could they tell him where this truck had been, where it was going, but they could tell him exactly where it was at that moment in time. It was traveling through the state of Nebraska.
This is a perfect example of something we were talking about in the Robert Ben Rhodes case of federal mandates from the FBI of requiring GPS locators to be on all trucks.
Yeah, and exactly. And this is a couple years after everything happened with Rhodes. So by this time, we're already seeing trucking companies who are using GPS capabilities to track their trucking. But Rhodes was a little bit before that technology ever came into existence. And that's probably why, or not probably, it's definitely how he was able to get away with a lot of his murders.
Yeah, and we're seeing the after effect of what happens when you put that in place.
Now you can track these kinds of things. So Watson contacted Nebraska Highway Patrol. He explained the situation, and he asked them to locate the truck and set up a roadblock to stop it. So when the truck came across the roadblock, at first it looked like the driver was going to try to run, which, I mean, guy, you're in an 18-wheeler. You're not going to get away from the cops. I don't know what you're trying to do here. So eventually they're able to stop him. They approach the truck, and guess who was inside hiding in the sleeping compartment?
I think it's going to be douchebag we're looking for, number one.
Yep, Troy Armstrong. And again, this was kind of a lark. There really wasn't much to go on to even suggest that Armstrong would be with this trucker friend of his.
It's almost a perfect hiding place for him.
Yeah, exactly. It absolutely was. And without this GPS, I mean, they wouldn't have been able to track the truck down. I mean, it would have been a whole mess.
Yeah, you're constantly on the move.
Yeah, exactly. It was actually a really good idea on Armstrong's part. But they were able to arrest him for the murder of Belinda Tillery.
Yes.
Yes. Well, upon his arrest, Armstrong was carrying a key to a storage locker back in New Mexico. So they go out to this locker to see if there's any evidence inside to connect him to Belinda's death. Well, inside the locker, they were able to find several items identified as belonging to Belinda. These were just like little personal items, i.e. stuff that you would take with you on a camping trip. They also found Belinda's driver's license. So again,
why would you have that?
Yeah, this is all stuff that Belinda would have had on her at the time of her death. Once Armstrong was arrested, Angela felt safe enough to tell the rest of her story. According to her, Armstrong had actually admitted to her that he had killed Belinda on that camping trip. And he had told Angela that if she told anyone, that he would kill her and her family as well. While she believed absolutely that he was capable of hurting her, I think she was able to kind of lie to herself into not believing his story, thinking that he was just threatening me, he's just trying to be scary, Belinda left town. You know, you're able to kind of make that make sense in your mind.
And he's trying to rekindle a relationship with her and cut off a loose end of his pregnancy that he has with this woman.
Yeah, like, oh, Belinda's gone. I killed her. So you can date me again. Sure, buddy. So yeah, initially she was really in denial about the whole thing. And she said, though, even though she had been kind of initially in denial about Troy Armstrong actually killing Belinda, the second she heard that Belinda's body had been found, she knew that it was Troy Armstrong who had killed her.
Yeah, and I understand her holding back a little bit of the story just for her own safety until he was apprehended.
At this time, she had two kids, she had a family, and he was missing. Nobody knew where she was, and she knew that he knew. He had told her about it. So, I mean, you're going to be terrified that he's going to come back and kill you to keep you from talking to the police. So, I mean, I think it was really brave of her to come forward and lead them to finding him.
At least she kept going with the continuing investigation and kept giving them more and more information, especially after he was captured.
Well, investigators and prosecutors were able to make a pretty strong case against Armstrong. They argued that Armstrong didn't want a baby and didn't want to be held financially responsible for any decision Belinda was going to make about that child. He also was probably pissed off that Angela had broken up with him because of Belinda and her pregnancy and blamed her for this. So he borrowed some camping equipment from some friends. He asked Belinda to come camping with him at Yellow House Canyon under the pretense that they could privately sit down and talk about the pregnancy. And instead, while her back was turned, he attacked her and stabbed her to death, then left her body in this vast, expansive, remote area, hoping no one would find her. He didn't even bury her or try to hide her body.
Ah, disgusting, dude.
Yeah.
It's just the blatancy of it, just leaving her out in the middle of nothing, that just adds on top of it. You know, it's the icing on the crap cake.
Yeah. Well, you'll like this part, though. In December of 1996, after a trial that lasted for 4 days, Troy Armstrong was found guilty of the murder in the first degree of Belinda Tillery. It took the jury less than 2 hours to deliberate.
That's pretty quick.
He was given a life sentence, where he currently still remains and hopefully probably will forever.
Good.
So there you go. That's the story of Belinda Tillery, this poor young woman whose whole life was ahead of her and was cut tragically short. And if it wasn't for the forensic anthropologist and the forensic artist, Belinda's body may have never been identified.
And the Lubbock Sheriff's Department reaching out to get these kinds of resources on a case like this. The victim, we see this all the time, whether you're a exotic dancer or a sex worker, a lot of these cases get lost, you know, in the confusion of all other crimes that are going on. Kudos to Lubbock Sheriff's Department for getting every resource that they could to try and figure out and solve this case.
Yeah, and I think we got to give big props to Angela.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
What she did to help the investigation was incredibly brave, and it took a lot of guts for her to lead them to his direction and eventually tell them what the full story was. And I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe she also testified against him in his trial. So
that's so brave.
Well, this is yet again another example of how dangerous domestic violence and intimate partner violence can be. A lot of studies have been done by various organizations, including the CDC, and these studies have suggested that homicide is one of, if not the leading cause of death of pregnant women. So this is statistically a time of real risk in a woman's life. That has actually led some people to suggest that women who are pregnant, whenever they go to the doctor for a checkup to see how the pregnancy is going, that they should also be screened for things like domestic violence and abuse as a method of intervention in these kinds of cases, sort of trying to identify the problem and get these women help before something bad happens. Because again, if you are a pregnant woman, statistically, your risk of being murdered is so much higher than any other point in your life. And it's very, very scary.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely getting these red flags of people who are in danger and in high risk situations and getting those people help and getting them the resources that they need for their situation would help a lot.
Yeah.
This was a great episode to kind of focus on forensic evidence and bone evidence from the bone lady. And we kind of got to see how the sausage is made when you look at bone evidence of a crime scene.
Yeah.
And also how important the body of the victim is in these cases, because a lot of times that's why criminals go to very long and ridiculous lengths to hide the body of their victim, because they might know that if you find the body, you can A, get a conviction a lot quicker, and B, find out the clues to pin it back on the person who did the crime. And this is how it's done. I think he did a great job of outlining all these basic layman's guidelines to how these techniques are used.
Thank you. And I got more. There is more where that's coming from. And if you guys are interested at all and you have questions, I love talking about bones. I could have done it for this entire episode just talking about the bones. So there's a lot more where that comes from. So if we ever do need to do a follow-up episode, if you guys are interested, or maybe a Patreon episode.
Yeah, we've been throwing that idea around.
You know, I can give you links and article. Ugh.
If you're interested in this kind of stuff, this kind of, like we said, how the sausage is made, for these kinds of real intensive looks into forensic techniques, if you're interested in those kinds of topics, let us know in the comments and hit us up, because we have an interest in doing more episodes like that and Patreon stuff.
Yeah. And it's a little bit different, I think, than you get with, you know, just a basic case where you're just talking about this person was murdered. How did they find out who killed
them?
You know, it's a different.
It's a good change of pace.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I thought you did a really good job, and it was very good.
I surely appreciate you. And you know what? You know what's really important now? I think it's time for some good, nice, excellent news.
So today's good news actually comes from our sister city, a place that people think that we hate, but we don't, and that we actually really enjoy going to and visit quite often. It comes from Dallas, Texas. And we talked about gorillas a little bit in this episode, and we're going to talk about gorillas some more in good news.
Yeah, I love a gorilla.
Dude, me too.
I think they are my favorite primate.
Yeah, one of mine. Yeah, I like gorillas a lot. Well, the Dallas Zoo recently announced the birth of a brand new baby gorilla. And this happened back on the 2nd of this month. And it's actually a baby that they haven't named yet. But the mother is a 22-year-old lowland gorilla named Hope. A western lowland gorilla, to be specific. This is actually really rare and really cool. And it's something that needs to be talked about, because baby gorillas don't happen very often in zoo situations, especially with western lowland gorillas, because they're endangered. Births in captivity don't happen very typically, and this is an awesome thing to be celebrated. They welcomed this new baby last week, and the infant is doing really well. It's the first gorilla that was born at the Dallas Zoo in 20 years, and only the 5th baby gorilla at the zoo in nearly 50 years.
Oh, wow.
That's how rare it is. They actually released a bunch of photos and photos of the baby with the mother, Hope. I'll definitely be tweeting out the links to this article so that you can see Hope and her baby together, and they're super cute. The birth actually was not only rare that it went forward and happened and had a successful baby, but the labor was really short and easy for the mother, which is another rarity in gorilla birthings in captivity. I didn't know if you knew that, but a lot of gorilla birthings actually have to get a specific gorilla veterinarians involved to aid the birth. That's how difficult it is to happen. Well, this one was super easy. It only took like an hour. And right after that, the zookeeper said that, quote, "Mom is tired, but she's tending to her infant perfectly, and the baby appears to be strong. It's gripping onto the mom and nursing frequently." Yeah, super sweet, right?
I love it.
Here's my favorite part. The silverback Suberia is his name, which I think is an awesome name for a male silverback gorilla. God, that's such a good name, Suberia. Well, he was quick to greet his first baby. He, quote, "gently put his lips on the infant's head shortly after birth and gave him a little kiss."
Oh, no.
Yeah. And you remember when Fort Worth had their baby gorilla? This was pretty recently, a couple years ago.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. We went and watched him, and the male silverback was very protective of his new little baby gorilla. And anytime he would get close to that protective moat, he'd go over and he would like give him a little pat and a little nudge and be like, "You need to get away from there. It's not safe." and he was always like watching around for the baby, you know, looking back and forth, and he'd always keep himself just out of the way, but always within close range of the baby and the mother. So that's a little endearing quality about gorillas that I love, especially in their behaviors with their children.
Yeah, and it's super great. I know a lot of people have issues, you know, with zoos, and obviously that's something that we could talk about for a long time. But I think it's important because we know that gorillas are so endangered. There's so few of them out in the wild. So having these births in captivity is important for hopefully one day being able to kind of repopulate those numbers of animals out in the wild. So it's really great to see. I love gorillas. Like I said, they're one of my favorite primates. So I think this is just a very cute story. So I love it.
And
I want to name him.
I know.
Is it a him or her?
We don't know yet. It's still early. What I will say is, piggybacking off of your talk about conservation, you know, zoos like to act like they do a lot more conservation than they actually do. But in this case with gorillas, they actually do a lot to conserve the species. In fact, Hope came from a New Mexico zoo where she gave birth back in 2004 to another baby, and they moved her to Dallas in hopes that Suburia would actually want to mate and make another baby, and it worked. So this is like proof of concept of moving and expanding gene pools between different zoos and keeping a healthy population of Western lowland gorillas active. So I think that's an awesome thing for zoos to be doing. Say what you will about the rest of their conservation efforts, but this time they did it right and it worked. So there
Yay.
You go.
Oh, little baby bean.
Yeah, little baby gorilla. So you wanted cute. To name him Pickles, or he or she. What about Bacon?
What about Aaron? Should name it after me.
Or Ham.
Ham the gorilla.
Any of those names are good. I like food names for animals. I don't know why.
It's because we like food too much.
Yeah. All right, ready? Let's move on to the self-aggrandizing portion of the podcast.
Oh, man, it's getting like that, guys. So if you've never heard this podcast before, we always end our show. Well, the very end is something a little bit different, but right now, this segment of the show is going to be reading our 5-star reviews. It's our little thank you to the people who like the show and take the time out of their schedule to give us 5 stars because they like the show and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, and you can do that on Facebook and you can just search All Crime No Cattle, or you can find us on iTunes, same way, All Crime No Cattle. Either place, if you want to give us 5 stars, do it and we'll read your review on the show.
That's right. And remember, you can also find us on other social media. You can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast, and you can find us on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle, and you can drop us a line. Any questions, comments, dumb remarks, or recommendations for future cases at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And remember, if you donate to Texas AccuSearch, to send your receipt over to us so we can add you to the raffle.
That's right.
Woo woo.
If you want to just straight up support the show, you can go to PayPal, donate us money there at our PayPal donation site. You can also go to threadless.com and search All Crime No Cattle and find all of our merch there, which goes to help the show and get us new equipment, you know, pay for all of our things, blah, blah, blah. Let's get on to the reviews, Aaron.
Okay. Well, heading on over to our Facebook reviews, Elizabeth Iavasile? I'm sorry, Elizabeth, if I'm probably butchering that.
Eye of the Seal? That sounds like a prog metal
band. Eye of the Seal. Elizabeth, I'm sorry. I don't know how to pronounce your last name. But this person says, I'm not sure how I recently stumbled onto this podcast, but it is possibly my favorite. I've been binge listening because I can't stop dreading catching up at the same time, because then I will be in withdrawal. I love the banter and I feel a great connection because it seems like I'm having the same reactions to the topics as whichever of you is doing the listening. It's obvious that you do a great amount of research. Each podcast is interesting without being dry and funny without being macabre or insensitive. Can't praise it enough. Keep up the great work. Holy crap, Elizabeth. What a fantastic review. Thank you so much. I'm so sorry that I don't know how to pronounce your name, but you're a wonderful person. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I love the part where you were like, I can't stop listening. Can't stop, won't stop is what I say.
That's right. We're on episode 25. We didn't even think about that. We're a quarter to 3 digits.
We're almost to Centaurian podcast level.
That's right. Amanda Hester said, love this podcast. I binged too fast and now I'm anxiously awaiting new episodes. I'm so glad you guys are Dallas Stars fans.
Yeah.
I also love Kari. In fact, I love goalies so much, I married one. Hashtag ghost stars, hashtag goalie wife. That's amazing.
You married a goalie? So did Aaron.
Well, I guess technically I did.
I played goalie.
Yeah.
It was intramural college hockey, but still, you married a goalie.
Amanda, let's talk about how Akari is no longer going to be part of the team. I don't know what to do about it.
I know.
It's really sad, Amanda, and I'm sure you feel my pain. So,
ghost stars.
Yeah, ghost stars. Shelby Michelson says, All Crime, No Cattle is one of the best true crime podcasts I've come across. I may be a little biased because as I am from the Arlington-Fort Worth area, I love listening about things that happened right in my backyard. Aaron and Shay remind me so much of me and my husband. I feel like I'm listening to friends. The coverage of crime is very well put together and satisfies my love for murder mystery. Thank you for the work you put into the cast.
Oh, that's perfect.
Thank you, Shelby. I think Very nice.
I think you highlighted a bunch of things that we actively are consciously thinking about when we're doing the podcast, and we try really hard at those things, and we appreciate that you appreciate those things.
That's right. And finally, our last one from Facebook is going to be from Angela Hoekwalker. And she is a friend of the podcast, and we met her through some of the murderina groups in the area. So thank you so much, Angela. She just says, love this podcast. And you know what, Angela? We love you, too.
I've met her in a local group, and we also saw her on stage at a My Favorite Murder show, which was awesome.
Back a couple of years ago.
Yep. She told her hometown murder, which was amazing, and she did a great job. And her husband also have a local engraving business, and they might be making some stuff for us in the future.
Ooh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, we're excited to promote their business.
Yeah. All right. That's it for Facebook. You got any good iTunes ones?
Boy, I sure do. I got some good ones. I got InstaJam, which said, love it, 5 stars. I love that the cases are from Texas. I love that I know where the places are in DFW. Also, y'all make me laugh even though they are sad stories. Good job. That's, again, something we try hard to do. We try to put an equal amount of humor to facts and details and appropriate sadness and honoring the victims. Moving on to our next review is from Dark Divide Pod.
Heyo!
They said, yeehaw, 5 stars. This is our friend Krista, who does Dark Divide Pod. We love Krista, and we hope she's doing well. We know that she has some new episodes coming out for her podcast. It's currently in hiatus, but it's a really good show. You should go check it out. She says, Shay and Aaron are amazing at what they do. They always pick such interesting cases and tell the stories in such a captivating way. Their chemistry is so great, and their production is ace. Great pod, good people. Give it a listen and be hooked instantly. She's also Canadian, like our friends Dark Poutine, and we love our loons, we love our Canadians, our Québécois. Hooray, Canada.
We're going to have to go to Canada one day.
I know. We've got a big following in Canada.
Canada sounds just like a great place to be. And thank you, Krista, for that.
Yeah, thank you, Krista. We hope you're doing well
love
in
you,
all of your adventures. Next up is Vinfett. I wonder if that's a play on Boba Fett, which is one of my favorite characters from Star Wars. They say hooked. 5 stars, and they start it with, so informative and always hilarious at the ending. New episodes are the best part of the week. Keep it up. Love ya. Thank you, Vinfett. We love you, too.
That's right.
Yeah, I like your name. Let's move on to the last segment of the show, which is recommendations. And this week, we're recommending one of my new favorite podcasts that I've stumbled on just a few weeks ago, which is Moms and Murder. Man, I really like Moms and Murder.
I do too.
Yeah, I put you onto it after they reached out to us, and I'd actually just started binging their show before they reached out to us to share promos with each other. And man, their show's great. I really love their show. They're funny. They're lovable. They have great back and forth and banter between each other. And they just do a great job of telling a story that makes you feel like you're at the kitchen table just talking to them.
Or at the bar sharing a pitcher of beer. Which is what I imagine.
Oh, okay. That's fine,
that's what
too.
I got going on in my head. Yeah, they're really fun. They have like 50-something episodes out, so you got a ton to binge through. I'm personally binging through it right now, and I'm really enjoying myself. They're great.
Yeah, and I'm super honored that they wanted to do a promo share with us because they're such a big, great podcast, and they're very popular. A lot of people love them, so go check them out. They're Floridians. They're from Florida, So they're fellow.
So you know they're cray-cray.
Yeah, they're cray-cray. And they're also from the Deep South, and they know what a gator is and what a crocodile is.
That's right. And if you like Texas cases, they have done several Texas cases on their podcast as well. So check that out. Go binge their podcast. It is great. We love them. I want to hang out with them. And you know what? I think you'll see us next week. Stay tuned for the recommendation. And I think that's everything for us, right?
That's right.
Yeah, we're done with episode 25.
Just do this 3 more times and we hit 100.
Wow. Suddenly that doesn't seem that impressive.
Yeah, and it's a lot of work that went into this first 25.
Holy crap, yeah.
But thank you guys for listening. Thanks for supporting. And as always, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.
Hey guys, it's Melissa
and Mandy
with the Moms of Murder podcast. We're a true crime podcast that's sure to make you laugh without compromising the seriousness of the content.
Despite our name, we aren't just for the moms. Our show is for all the Diet Coke drinking, chicken loving, Dateline watching people in your life. Come for the murder and stay for the witty humor and pop culture references.
And you never know, you may even hear from some of your favorite names in the world of true crime. Like Dateline's Josh Mankiewicz.
Do you have a preference on what we call you, Josh Mankiewicz, Manx, Sir Manx-a-Lot?
I don't hear Sir Manx-a-Lot quite as often as I
I can make it happen for you. Like I will to, make it happen.
But... Broken Homicide's Derek Lavasser.
Are you tearing up on me? I saw you waiting.
So beautiful, everything you're saying.
Or even America's sweetheart, Allie Sweeney.
The neighbor suggested that perhaps Kathleen had been attacked by an owl.
The owl theory that Melissa and Allie Sweeney believe.
Again, so judgy.
Check out Moms and Murder anywhere podcasts are found.